Thank you, Grady. I'm not sure. I know you've heard of the term anticlimax, but I'll bet you never looked at one before. I certainly feel like I am now. I'm going to do what little I can and get the hell out of here. The only thing I got going for me today is to be brief. I always have difficulty, and I guess I always will, in AA, identifying myself. I think I should. I think everybody who speaks to an AA group should identify himself. My name is Ed Keith, and I don't know exactly what I am in this capacity. I'm not an Al-Anon, because I'm not married to an alcoholic. And we think she isn't either, so... At least we like to say that, so we don't think that I am an alcoholic. So I'm someplace in between an Al-Anon and an alcoholic. I don't know what that is. Somebody, though, one time said, as long as I could say, and I can say, I haven't had a drink today yet. So this qualifies me to be here. As long as I haven't had a drink today yet. Somebody, though, I think maybe has put me in the right category. Just last night, one of my supporters from up north, way up north, one of the people who likes to see me because he likes to say these good and helpful things to me, you know, always, said that he's figured it out about me. And he said he figured out that I'm someone who has all the symptoms of an alcoholic without the allergy, but I'm working on it. And I think this may very well categorize me. Someone helped me along this a little different line just yesterday in telling me a little story that he, you know, I hear all the preacher jokes, you know. Most of them I've already heard, and most of them I've made up, but this was one I had not, and this sort of, I think is very explanatory and helpful. This cannibal in some place where cannibals operate went into the supermarket and wanted some brains. Naturally human brains, and the supermarket dealt in human brains, and so he looked over on the shelf, and here were several different categories of brains, and there was lawyer's brains, marked $1 a pound, and under that there was doctor's brains, and they were $1.50 a pound, and then under that there was still another category, and there was preacher's brains, and they were $2 a pound, and the guy says, well, how come, he asked the proprietor, how come the preacher's brains are more than some of the others? And he said, you would never believe how many preachers we had to kill to get that pound of brains. That is extremely, extremely helpful and extremely descriptive. I have a sadness this morning, not nobody's fault but my own, but I'm not going to be able to stay for the entire weekend, and this is, I guess, about the first time that I've not been able to do this. I think there was one other time, but I can't remember it too well. I've got to go back. I've been away from a little church that I'm involved with so much this year that, and they have some silly notion about my being there on Sunday, you know. They say these silly things like the attendance goes down and the collection goes down when I'm not there and all that nonsense. And I sort of promised them that I'd be there. And I don't know, somehow or other my presence is supposed to do something. And I do open all the doors in the morning and turn the heat on and make sure the cook machine is filled. And this helps. But I am going to have to leave this afternoon. And in this connection, I've been asked to make an announcement that, you know, we always have a communion service on Sunday morning, and we will have a communion service in the morning. It'll be a little different from what we have done before. Phil McDaniel is going to front this, and we've asked him to do this, not because Phil has any more ability than anybody else, but because he just had to be the one we ask. So don't put him on the spot. We're going to meet downstairs in the library, and it's going to be the Liturgy of the Church of South India, with which some of you are familiar, a very delightful and magnificent service, one which does not really need an official clergyman to do. And it's going to be a communion service, similar to the ones we've had, but administered a little differently. And I'm sure that you will enjoy it and derive some benefit from it. So it will be at 7:30 in the library downstairs. And Phil will need your help with this, too. Well, I've been asked to make another announcement, too. Because the service is at 7:30, breakfast, you notice on your schedule, breakfast is at 8:30. Well, I've been asked to announce that breakfast in the morning will be promptly at 8:40. As it was scheduled this morning to be at 8 o'clock, you know. We start on time around here. Probably, and I say, I don't know what I have to qualify myself or really what I have to offer to AA. I still am amazed by my involvement in AA. I don't think that a day goes by that I do not in some way use an illustration that I have learned in AA. I'm hooked on it, really. And everybody who talks to me knows that I'm going to eventually come up with something that can be helpful that I have learned from AA. And it has been tremendously helpful to me. I've been around AA longer than I've been in the ministry. And I think that the order is real helpful to me. And I've learned so much, so much. And this is my selfish reasons why I still hang around, of course, because I need it. I need it desperately. And I need what you give me. This morning, I'm going to do something I've never done here before. I'm going to repeat myself. You know, after nine times, I don't know, maybe I didn't have anything to say after six times new. But anyway, I'm going to go back to the beginning. I'm going to start all over. This is the same thing I did the first time. All those many years ago when we first started. I've never heard a sober alcoholic say this. Maybe it's taboo in AA. I've heard some drunks say this, but I've never heard a sober alcoholic say this. And if I just did not have this handicap of being an alcoholic, boy, nothing could stop me. I'd have the world by the tail. Everything would be going my way. But you see, I've got this handicap, and so this holds me back. Now, like I say, I've never heard a sober one say that, but maybe somebody thinks this. And when I don't ever try to qualify what I'm trying to say. When I'm talking to, I figured everybody in the room is an alcoholic in some degree, so I don't ever distinguish between alcoholics and non-alcoholics. Because I know, as you do, I know many alcoholics who don't drink. But maybe somebody thinks this. If I just didn't have this handicap, you know, if I had the handicap of being married to an alcoholic, you know, what a great life it would be, what a great person I would be. Well, I don't think I have ever met anybody in this world who does not in some way have some kind of a handicap. And most people have more than one. Everybody has handicaps. Maybe they don't go around talking about them. Maybe they're not as obvious as being an alcoholic, but they have them. Everybody has them. And maybe some robust person who thinks, well, I don't. But It's either because he hasn't lived long enough or because he's not very bright. If you read anything, if you ever read biography, which is a great way to learn about somebody, you learn this real quick. Everybody's got handicaps. Some way, somehow. And in no small degree, I strongly feel that a person's spiritual growth is directly related to how he deals with his handicaps. Not what he does with what he has, not what he does with all the good things he has going for him, but what he does with the things that hold him back. One's spiritual growth is directly related to what he does with his handicaps, how he reacts to them. Sometimes when you read biography, you might be disillusioned about some of your heroes because you find that they all had something that was giving them difficulty. They all had human frailties just like all of us, but also they had handicaps. And more often than not, it was because of a handicap that made a person the great person that he was. We think, for example, of a man like Pasteur, on whose research and understanding and insight modern medicine rests. Here was a man who must have had everything going for him. But if you read a little bit about Mr. Pasteur, you learn that he had a paralytic stroke at the age of 46. And he spent the rest of his life, and most of his productive work was done after this. He was hardly able to get around. Or we see people like Beethoven writing music, although deaf, stone deaf, writing some of the world's greatest music. Milton writing some of the world's deeply moving poems out of his blindness. And we could go on and on and on describing people. They may have faults and frailties, sure, but they have handicaps too, something they've got to overcome in order to be productive and to be helpful. Well, how do they do this? How do people deal with these things? Have they got some extra something going for them that the average person doesn't have? I don't think so. What is this inward technique which these people use to handle their limitations? Well, needless to say, no one of us would not be eager to know what the answer is. How did you overcome your handicap so that maybe I can overcome mine the same way? Well, biography in the Bible, by the way, is no different from biography in the life, other people's lives we read about. It confirms the universality of what I'm saying. I have a favorite in the scriptures also, as many people do. My favorite is a fellow named Paul. And what I've read about Paul and what I understand about him, he was a mess. He was really a mess. He was probably a very little fellow, very small. And he had all sorts of physical difficulties, all sorts of limitations. You know, he wrote about himself. He said, "I have a thorn in the flesh." But he never said what it was. He called it a messenger from Satan to harass me. And he says, "I besought the Lord many times to remove this thing from me." And he tells us this much. And he says, "The Lord said to me, 'Don't worry about it, son. My strength will be in your weakness. So go on.'" And no one knows, as we say, what Paul's thorn in the flesh was. Some people say it was epilepsy. Some people say it was semi-blindness. Maybe he was an alcoholic. It's entirely possible. Entirely possible that Paul was an alcoholic. Nobody knows. Many have been the guesses, but no one really knows. Chances are, if Paul had been like some of us, though, somebody would have known. Somebody would have known. Can you imagine? Can you imagine writing all of those letters, and not telling anybody? Well, he must have chosen to keep his thorn in the flesh anonymous. Now, you make of that what you will, but it's possible. This boy had a problem. But anyway, we know nothing about his problem, really, except that behind the scenes, like the rest of us, like every one of us, he had to handle a limitation that he prayed to escape and yet he could not evade, and he had to settle down and live with somehow or other, and he really did something with it, in spite of it. How we would like to ask him, handicapped man that he was, and yet radiant in personality and responsible for the whole Christian movement, how we would like to ask him, "How'd you do it, Paul? How'd you do it? How'd you handle it? What was, as you say, the grace that was sufficient for you?" How well we know that the central problem of our spiritual lives lies not in the theological or the ecclesiastical or the liturgical matters that are discussed so often in church, but the central problem in our spiritual lives really is, how in the hell do I make it through the day, limited the way I am, living in the with the stuff that I have to put up with, how am I going to make it? And I sometimes get a little distressed with my colleagues and my brethren who seem to answer so many, many questions that nobody's asking. This is one of the characteristics, it seems, of the clergy. When people, I think, people are sitting there just saying, how do I do it? Limited the way I am, stuck with what I am stuck with, burdened with the burdens that I carry, how do I make it? It's almost that simple, I think. Don't tell me your profound theological diatribes. Don't fill me with ecclesiastical, liturgical tomes. Tell me, how do I make it? I think this is the real problem of our spiritual growth. Here's a child born, a cripple, physically, or crippled in early infancy. He grows up through the first years of his life. He doesn't know anything's wrong with him. But then one day he notices that he's not like other children, or other children not like him. And he begins to recognize that he's different. And then what he does about that difference determines the entire course of the rest of his life. Or here's a man whose parents didn't understand the critical importance of the experiences of childhood. He now wakes up to discover that something's wrong inside of him. All of his basic emotions flow in channels of distrust and suspicion and fear and anxiety, until he finally says to himself that he among all men is most cursed. There are also some limitations that lie in personal relationships. Here's a life that begged for love and missed it. Or a home that where marriage has been a thing of beauty and has turned into an ugly, terrible thing. Our family, where a child was greeted as a blessing and turned out to be an agony instead. Or a household where death has severed a tie that was the support and the glory of the family. Or a life where alcoholism has taken its toll and left nothing but tragedy and suffering and pain in its wake. Among the few things that are true of all of us is the fact that each one of us has some handicaps. How then shall we deal with these things? What do we do about them? Where is the grace that is sufficient for us? As Paul said, God told him, "My grace is sufficient for you. Go on, do what you have to do." Where's the grace that's sufficient for us? Well, I feel that in the first place, if we're going to do anything really meaningful with this, with a handicap, we've got to deal with it constructively. And I don't mean positive thinking. I mean, you know, don't worry about it. Don't think about it. It'll go away. That's not the way to deal constructively or creatively with our handicaps. But we do have to take a positive attitude toward them. And how we rebel against this? How we rebel against it? The admission of our handicaps oftentimes is like the first step in AA, to admit that I was powerless over alcohol, of course, is the hardest step, and to admit that we've got a handicap oftentimes is the first and most difficult step. Why should I be thwarted by this thorn in the flesh, we ask. And oftentimes only bitterness and resentment is the answer. Although he may not articulate it, I can imagine many an alcoholic has said, why can't I take a drink like everybody else? Why should it be me? Why have I been singled out? Why can't I drink like everybody else? Oh, miserable man that I am. I truly am miserable. Many people, of course, try self-pity. This is a common escape. They stroke their wounded spirits. Trying to get somebody else to stroke them. It's always more comfortable to get somebody else to stroke your wounded spirit. Isn't it funny? You got some place that itches, you know, and it's always better for somebody else to scratch it than for you to scratch it yourself. I don't know why this is. It always feels better. But a person says, oh, if I didn't have this handicap, what a great person I would be. What a great person I would be if I just didn't have this thing, if I could get rid of it. And so we begin to drift into imaginings of all sorts of things. What we would be without these things. And become sorry for themselves and for this thorn in the flesh that keeps them from so glorious a paradise. Well, this obviously is not the way to deal with a handicap. I've told a story before. If somebody asked me if I were going to tell this again, and I found a way to work it in. Right here is the spot. It illustrates this point, really. It's not a story. It's a sort of a play on something or other about how some people face life. It's about little Johnny who, on his way to school one day, and he's forgotten, and he remembers he's got an arithmetic test. What in the world is he going to do? He hadn't studied. He forgot all about it. He thinks, well, he'll go back home and pretend he's sick. And he decides, well, no, I won't do that either. I'll go on and I'll do it. So he gets to school, and sure enough, the thing that he feared came to pass. The arithmetic test was passed out, and he looked at it, and he knew he was in trouble, but he decided he'd give it a try. And so he worked problem one he wasn't too sure about, and he worked problem two, and he was less sure about, and he got to problem three, and he didn't know what in the world to do. So he decided, I'm going to solve this problem, so he throws up. Literally throws up. And the teacher sees him, oh, poor little Johnny, he's sick. And they rush him to the nurse's office, and they clean him up and fix him up and give him a little dose of medicine and take him to the principal, and they send him home. And Johnny is sick. And mother comforts him and pets him and puts him to bed, and daddy comes home and sees how he is and brings him a toy, and sister, for once, you know, is solicitous of him. And he says, man, this is the way to deal with life. And so ever after that, then, when Johnny has a problem he can't deal with, he throws up. And now Johnny is a grown man, still throwing up when he can't face life. And he says, oh, if I didn't have this stomach, you know, if I didn't have this fouled up stomach, what a great person I would be. And nobody, someplace along the line, has ever taken the trouble to tell Johnny what his problem really is. He didn't consciously do this. He unconsciously did it. And this is what can happen to anybody. We can unconsciously do this. Deal this way with our handicaps. A person, though, has got to deal with his handicap more creatively and more courageously than this, if he's going to receive the grace that is sufficient for him. I feel safe in saying that no one who ever lived has ever lived his life out under ideal conditions. And I'd be willing to risk that if anybody in this room is living his life under ideal conditions, I want to meet him. I want to meet him. I read a story once about a great violinist who was performing on a stage in Paris. Standing out there on the stage all by himself with the orchestra accompanying him, playing this magnificent composition, and the A string on his violin snapped. Never happens, but it happened. And right there on the stage with hundreds of people watching and listening, without even hesitating, he stopped for a few moments, transposed the composition that he was playing and finished it on three strings. Now, this to me is the illustration of life. Every one of us has got someplace a busted string. Every one of us. And life is made up of playing the composition that has been given to us on three strings. I think as much as I would like to have heard this great violinist with a full orchestra and a perfect violin at his command, if I'd never heard him, if I could only hear him once, I think I'd prefer to hear him the time when his A string snapped. And he finished it on three strings. This is what life is all about. For everybody. Not just for an alcoholic, or somebody married to an alcoholic, or somebody who's a friend or the loved one of an alcoholic. It's true for everybody. So much of the thrilling part of human history in this world lies in our capacity to overcome our handicaps. As soon as a person begins to take, I feel, as soon as a person begins to take a positive attitude toward his handicap, it begins to present itself to him as an opportunity. Always challenging and sometimes fascinating. 95% of the things that happen to us in this world we cannot help. But we can control how we react to them. Life, as someone has said, this old cliche, it's so doggone true. Just because it's old and just because it's a cliche, it doesn't make it any less true. Life is 95% how you take it and 5% what you make it. This is true. Paul did not want his thorn in the flesh. He was a temperamental, vigorous, active, and aggressive man. Now he must have rebelled against this thing. He prayed many times that it would depart from him. But I suspect that there are qualities of understanding and sympathy in Paul and a deep, moving music in some of the passages in his letters to us that would never have been there had he not had to finish his life on three strings. Would never have been there. I have a friend in a large Midwestern university who tells me that in all the years that he was there, he never heard such cheering, such applause, such real joy, even at a football victory, as he saw at a commencement exercise once, when a young man was carried in the arms of two of his classmates up to get his diploma. It seems that this young man, 4 years before, was in one of his first classes, and the professor was calling the roll. And this young man answered, and everybody else was standing and saying, "Here, sir," and the professor was looking and seeing getting some way to identify the face with the name. And the young man said, "Here, sir," and he didn't stand. The professor said, "Stand up so I can see you." And the young fellow said, "I'm sorry, sir, I can't stand. I've been crippled since I was 4 years old." Well, they let it go, and they figured, well, we'll put up with him, you know. But because this boy's attitude, because he looked positively and creatively at himself, 4 years later he graduated at the head of his class in tough competition. And this was the response that he was getting when they carried him up to get his diploma. The likes of which that crowd had never seen before, they had never experienced. If you say it takes faith to live like that, you're right. If you say it takes courage, you're right. If you say there are going to be hours when you're going to hate this handicap, you're justified. Whatever it is. Even Christ, I remember, prayed against his handicap. He did everything he could to avoid it. I don't care what you say, being crucified on a cross at age 33 is a handicap. No matter how you look at it. If it be possible, he said, let this thing pass from me. But as it turned out in the end, no cross would have meant no crucified and no resurrected Lord. And so the very thing he prayed against was the very thing. It was his shining and greatest thing. Remember, it was not the Greek god Apollo, beautiful, magnificent symbol of manhood, charioteer of the victorious sun. It was not Apollo that won the world. It was a broken, crucified, handicapped Christ. Now, obviously, what I've been trying to say is there may be one of you who, even though you are sober, still consider your alcoholism a handicap. Or there may be one of you married to an alcoholic who still considers this a handicap. Many times you may be bitter and resentful because of your thorn in the flesh. What a great person I would be if I didn't have to deal with this thing, if I didn't have to live with this. But may I remind you that in hearing you in countless meetings and talking to you personally and feeling the tremendous import of your life on mine and consequently the thousands of people that my life imports on, and watching you stand by someone whom no one else has been able to reach, not me, not the doctor, not the loved one, and help get that person's attention and literally help him to return from death to life,